Sunday, June 5th, was a happy day, remarkably unmarred by the Gallup poll headlines, President's standing lowest in 30 months. Fewer Americans today express confidence in the way President Johnson is handling his job than in any previous time in the 2.5 years that he's been in office. In May, it had been 54%. Now, it is 46% who approve. Not that the disapprovals have grown, only 1%. But those who have no opinion have grown from 13% in May to 20% in June. It was interesting to see that the happy Eisenhower, in his 8 years, only fell to 49 at the lowest, whereas Truman, beset with Korea and hitting it head-on, had at one point fallen to a low of 23%. I was also equally surprised that Roosevelt had a low of 50%. Other headlines showed the impact of beautification, conservation of our new awareness. Rock Creek, a beautiful sewer, in the Star. And a story about the Big Bend as a vacation place. Time marched tirelessly in Big Bend. You can see into day after tomorrow. And another about the Mall Temple's fall. Either the country is waking up to a new interest, or my eyes are just coming open. There were, unhappily, several stories, Isabel Shelton and Betty Beale, about Washington becoming a swinging set. Rather sympathetically handled, I thought. But what I want to read about it is nothing. We went into Johnson City with a Christian church, taking the bishops with us on very short notice. They dressed in about 5 minutes and had no breakfast, and have not quite accommodated yet to the pace at which Lyndon moves. It was a delightful service conducted by the children, all the way from the hymns, the old familiar Onward Christian Soldiers, in the passing of the communion, to the sermon, many names so familiar to Lyndon. Summy, Glidden, Bushnell, Haley, and the children, sober, composed, going about their duties with dignity, while a blonde lady on the left, who I believe had coached everybody, watched anxiously, and Lyndon leaned over and said, "She reminds me of my mother. Mother was always doing everything like this that took place." I had the feeling that all the congregation was pulling for them and smiling inwardly. Afterwards, Lyndon shook hands and congratulated the pianist and the preacher and the 7-year-old little blonde girl who'd read the poem. And then we set out for home, all feeling happier, I think, for having come, though I dare say it was a strange sight to the bishops. Lyndon called the Crims and Vicky and Marie and Linda and George, and they met us at the Lewis place, the bishops still without any breakfast. And we were off on one of his open-end safaris, the Logan and then the Scharnhorst. Somewhere along the way, the bishops left and went home to eat. But we continued on for the first time into the Tomlinson, some 700 acres of pasture land that we are leasing and had been doing some cutting work in. It was beautiful, good grass, but rough country. Suddenly to our left, lying in the brush, not more than 10 feet from the car, saw a little spotted fawn, motionless as a shadow, looking at us as though mesmerized. I called softly back for my camera, but before it could be brought up, he leapt to his shaky little legs and went bounding off into the deep thickets. It was not more than 5 minutes later that, rounding a curve in the rough, new-cut road, we stirred a whole cloud of hideous buzzards into angry, awkward flight. That was their prey, hanging on the fence, a deer who had caught his leg in the top strand of the barbed wire and had hung there. They always kick frantically, usually breaking the leg, until he died. Very quickly, we had gone the whole circle, from new life to death. You see the whole drama of nature in all its gentle charm and cruel ugliness when you walk a ride around the country. It was 3:30 before we got back to the ranch house. We were famished and sat down to a delicious big lunch at which Judge Heath joined us. He's leaving for the Far East tomorrow, and he'd come over to talk business with Lyndon. I was so glad that Linda and George had stayed with us. I want to spend the time, the companionship it takes to get to know him better. In Arthur talked about show business and personalities. He and Linda seem remarkably companionable. I think it's a play between them of things the other did not have. For Linda, excitement, freedom, somewhat spicy life of show business. For him, could it be perhaps solid education, the real interest in learning, and I would hope the fairly deeply rooted family life she has had? Lyndon is never ready to stop motion. I wish sometimes that he lay in the hammock more by the pool, and just gave his thoughts to the clouds, and felt the breeze, let the bird song sink into his consciousness. But no, a little past 5 picked us all up. Crims, bishops, Linda, and George. We stopped for the Morsons at that ranch, and then went on to what he calls the Crim estate, the outlines of a house are taking shape. Lovely Matilda surveyed it with a happy proprietary air. Lyndon keeps on speaking of his room and of the birthday party she's going to give him there. I think they will set a good example in taste and in conservation practices. I do not believe a bulldozer will rip up the mesquite and the persimmon and the Christmas cactus. At the beach house, we were joined by Jesse and Carolyn and Tom, whom Lyndon himself had called. There was only one swift moment for him between thinking of something thoughtful and kind and doing it. We spent the sunset hours, Lyndon in the fast boat, free and relaxed with Matilda and Arthur, and Linda and George, and I on the more staid big boat with some of the more staid company. Marie and Vicky came to meet us back at Mary Margaret's house, and then we all got on the big boat, and in the dying light proceeded back to the Haywood, where we had a delicious dinner. It was there that Jim Bishop told a remarkable story about a Dr. Lisa Meitner, a woman scientist, who somehow came into possession of the information on Fermi's test, the beginning of the long chain of breaking the atom. She applied for permission to go to Denmark on a vacation. This was in 1934, and I'm a little vague as to whether she was in Mussolini's Italy or Hitler's Germany. At any rate, much hung on her ability to get out for the vacation. Somehow she did, went to Dr. Niels Bohr in Denmark, who was about to catch the boat to go to the United States to lecture, thrust herself into his presence just at the last moment. He, at first exasperated, and then with deep excitement, listened to her information. He promised to take it out to the United States. He did, to Dr. Teller. From there it went to someone named Szilard, and then to Einstein, with the hope that Einstein's name, his great prestige, could bring it to the attention of the President of the United States. Actually, Einstein went through still another man, who was a friend of FDR's. FDR listened and got a $6,000 appropriation to start the Atom Project. This was in 1934. What a gossamer thread of circumstance and uncertainty these events hung on that have since shaken the world. James Bond has nothing to match them. A charming sidelight was that Arthur said, Matilda and I met one evening at Dr. Neal's bars. He was a wonderful man. Matilda herself is a scientist, and they filled in sidelights of the story. We were home at a reasonably early hour because the Krims had to fly back to New York that night. Not only he, but she. It's a hard worker in a tense field.